From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. It's Norman Mailer's 80th birthday. On today's Fresh Air, we feature an interview with the celebrated writer, and our book critic Maureen Corrigan reflects on his career. His books include The Naked and the Dead, Advertisements for Myself, and The Armies of the Night. Also, we'll talk with rapper Melly Mel. He was the vocalist on the rap classic The Message by Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five. The Library of Congress has just chosen The Message for its National Recording Registry. And TV critic David Bianculli previews two new shows starting this Sunday, Dragnet and Kingpin. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The chief United Nations weapons inspectors have said they might accept a surprise invitation to visit Baghdad if Iraq concedes on two main issues of dispute. So far, Iraq has shown no inclination to compromise. NPR's Ann Garrels reports from Baghdad.
An advisor to President Saddam Hussein, Amir al-Sadi, has invited the two chief UN weapons inspectors back to Baghdad in order to show Iraq is willing to be more cooperative. The UN inspectors make a critical report to the UN Security Council on February 14th, and al-Sadi said he hoped the inspectors could return here well before then. Mohammed al-Baradei, who heads up the nuclear weapons inspection, said he was willing to consider the invitation if Baghdad shows a willingness to allow surveillance flights, as well as interviews with Iraqi scientists without Iraqi minders. After a visit earlier this month in which Iraq promised more cooperation but failed to provide it, al-Baradei indicated he wanted assurances these were not just more empty promises. So far, Iraqi officials have showed little flexibility. Ann Garrels, NPR News, Baghdad.
At a joint news conference today with British Prime Minister Tony Blair, President Bush dismissed Iraq's offer to talk with the top UN inspectors.
We know what a disarmed regime looks like. We know what it means to disarm. There's no negotiations. The idea of calling inspectors in to negotiate is a charade. If he is going to disarm, he must start disarming. That's the only thing he needs to talk to the inspectors about is, here, I'm disarming.
The president said Iraq will be called to account for its failure to disarm in a matter of weeks, not months. Prime Minister Blair said the crisis is a test of the international community. Police in Naples, Italy, have arrested 28 Pakistani men suspected of belonging to a terrorist cell linked to al-Qaeda. Nancy Greenlease reports from Rome.
Authorities released a statement confirming the men's arrests on charges related to terrorism. Earlier this week, police were conducting a routine sweep for illegal immigrants and burst into a rundown property in the city center in an organized crime neighborhood. Inside, the police said they discovered dynamite, explosive fuse, and detonators. The materials were tucked behind a false wall. The raid also uncovered forged identity documents, cell phones, and thousands of international phone numbers and addresses. Maps of Naples were found, and the police said sensitive targets were circled. Unidentified sources told an Italian news agency that the targets included the U.S. consulate in Naples and nearby NATO bases. Security has been increased at all U.S. naval facilities in Italy as a result of the arrests. For NPR News, I'm Nancy Greenlease in Rome.
In stocks today, the Dow gained 108 points to close at 8,053 in heavy trading. This is NPR News. High school basketball star LeBron James has been ruled ineligible for the rest of the season because he accepted a gift from a clothing store in exchange for posing for pictures to be hung in the store. NPR's Tom Goldman reports.
For the past couple of months, LeBron James has been on a dizzying joyride as the top high school basketball player in the land. He's had national TV appearances, shoe companies wanting to sign him to endorsement deals, and NBA teams salivating over the likelihood that he'll bypass college for the pros. Friday, however, the joyride came to a screeching halt, albeit temporary. Ohio high school officials ruled that James forfeited his amateur status by accepting from a clothing store at no cost two retro sports jerseys worth more than $800. The ruling came just a few days after James was cleared for receiving as a gift a new sports utility vehicle from his mom. James will not be able to play in the final five games of the season or the Ohio State tournament. Tom Goldman, NPR News.
A federal jury in San Francisco has convicted an advocate of medical marijuana on charges of growing more than 1,000 marijuana plants. Ed Rosenthal has proclaimed himself the guru of ganja. He's written several books on growing marijuana and provided the drug to a medical marijuana program in Oakland. Rosenthal was able to grow marijuana under a California law that was approved by voters in 1996, but federal authorities don't recognize the state law. Rosenthal was one of several marijuana suppliers who were arrested last year by the Federal Drug Enforcement Administration. He faces a maximum sentence of life in prison when he's sentenced in June. Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Amundsen Foundation for support of the Endowment Fund for NPR West, NPR's new production center in Los Angeles.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, sitting in for Terry Gross. Norman Mailer once wrote that before he was 17, he had formed the desire to be a major writer. Well, that wish certainly came true, and today he turns 80. To celebrate, we'll listen back to a conversation Terry recorded with Mailer in 1991. But first, we have this appreciation from Fresh Air's book critic, Maureen Corrigan.
The Lion in Winter. Norman Mailer turns 80 today. In his youth, Mailer wrote an essay about meeting the aged Dorothy Parker in Hollywood. He was appalled by her overpowdered nose and her eyes, baggy from decades of drink. Now, for younger generations, Mailer is the literary relic, pickled in bourbon. Not that, as a social critic, he ever seemed quite au courant, with his chest thumping against women's libbers and gays, his weird encomiums to the primitive cool of black men, his penchant for He-Man sports like boxing and bullfighting, already derivative of Hemingway's, and his screeds against the computer and television. Mailer always seemed like a literate Hepcat version of Archie Bunker, a man proudly and loudly out of joint with his time, a public man easy to mock, that is, until you read him. There's lots of Mailer to read, and there's lots to avoid. That's the problem with hitting it big early, as Mailer did at age 25 with his first novel, The Naked and the Dead, based on his army experiences in World War II. That early debut gave Mailer a lot of time to make mistakes. But part of his appeal is that he's husky, outsized. So when he makes mistakes, they're whoppers, like the more recent novels on ancient Egypt and the life of Christ. And when he publishes collections of his prose and fiction, like the Whitman-esque Advertisements for Myself and the beefy 1998 retrospective, The Time of Our Time, they're marbled through with lard that arguably makes the prime cuts all the more succulent. The book of Mailer's that I've read and reread, the book that devastates me with its high culture brilliance, street smarts, humor, and serpentine sentence structure, is The Armies of the Night, his 1968 account of the March on the Pentagon that won him the Pulitzer Prize and the National Book Award. Even the best accounts of the public events of the 1960s that I've read by other writers seem momentarily flat by comparison. In Armies, Mailer ruminates on the folly of the war in Vietnam and the easy arrogance of the New Left. He probes the fissures between his public and private identity and charts his two-day drinking binge. Pompously and nervously, he compares himself to fellow protester, poet Robert Lowell. Mailer also beats the postmodern theorists by a good decade in meditating on the porous boundaries between fiction and history. Not to mention that long before the term political correctness was revived as a pejorative, Mailer nailed political correctness in Armies as he contemplates the apartment of a liberal academic who hosts a party for him and the other eminent men of letters joining the march. Listen to Mailer. Conservative professors tend to have a private income, so their homes show the flowering of their taste. But liberal professors are usually poor and programmatic, so secretly they despise the arts of home adornment. Their houses look one like the other, for the wives gave up Herculean careers as doctors, anthropologists, labor relations experts. Great servants of the social program were lost when the women got married and relinquished all for Hubber and the kids. So the furnishings are functional. The prevailing hues of wall and carpet and cloth are institutional brown and library gray. The paintings and sculpture are abstract, hopeless imitation Ben Shahn. But bet your $25 to win an assured $10 that the artist on the wall is a friend of the host, has the right political ideas, and will talk about literature so well you might think you were being addressed by Maxim Gorky. In scope and prose style, Mailer reads here like one of the great Victorian social critics, Thomas Carlyle, John Ruskin, Matthew Arnold, whom he references in the title of Armies. Except that, unlike his fellow sages, Mailer is funny and randy and self-buffooning. His personal tetchiness in that passage expands outward into a larger epiphany about American life. That's how Armies of the Night works, as well as his other masterpieces of new journalism, the literary form that Mailer helped pioneer in the 1960s. The contemporary lesser inheritors of new journalism take themselves way too seriously. Mailer's genius in Armies, in Miami and the Siege of Chicago, and even in his nonfiction novel The Executioner's Song, derives from his bear-hug grip on absurdity. Unlike his idol Hemingway, Mailer has always played the tough guy as clown. Whether you're fighting a war or opposing one, he's the writer you want with you in the foxhole.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. We're celebrating Norman Mailer's 80th birthday today. In 1991, he spoke with Terry Gross.
I think you were one of the first great American writers to also be a media personality, and to have that personality be, in a way, a part of your art. Do you think of yourself, or at least your public self, as being one of your greatest characters?
No, I'm amused by it because people have such an outlandish idea of me, and I'm always intrigued with it. They really are so surprised when they meet me. You know, if I've heard one remark 1,000 times in my life, it's that, oh, you know, you're not the least bit the way I thought you'd be. I'm a measure of how bad and inaccurate the newspapers are. Most, after all, the sad truth is that most people who write for newspapers are mediocre writers. And so... The mark of mediocrity is to look for precedent. So they'll open the files on me, and whatever's been written about me before gets written again, thereby confirming the error.
But you did at some point, I think, almost make a decision to cultivate a public personality on TV. You know, on the Cavett Show, on Merv, on David Susskind's show. You know, saying really provocative things. I mean, you even write in advertisements. I think it was in advertisements for myself about how you'd kind of like studied TV to think about how you could best come across on it and to most kind of accurately get across the thought or the emotion that you wanted to.
Yeah, but I've given up on that. I don't think you can communicate through TV. Some people may be able to, but I can't. My ideas are too...
complicated?
Yes, too complicated, too full of, I'll say it, too full of nuance. When you start trying to communicate through TV or, for that matter, through newspaper stories, your remarks get garbled and bizarre. I mean, whenever I read a story about myself, I generally shudder a bit. I say, oh, what a bizarre, ugly, sort of off-balance person I appear to be in that story.
You used to always measure yourself against other writers. In advertisements for myself, you wrote, "It is my present and future work which will have the deepest influence of any work being done by an American novelist in these years. I could be wrong, and if I am, then I am the fool who will pay the bill." Do you think your assessment of your own work has changed over the years?
I think I'm a little more relaxed about it. Either my work will or it won't have all that huge effect. Sometimes I hope it will. Sometimes I think it absolutely won't. My real fear these days is not who's going to be the best writer of us all, but whether novel writing as such is going to continue with any health into the 20th century. I'm not sure it's going to. I think 50 years from now, novelists may be looked upon as the way most people regard poets, which is, they do a very special kind of work. It doesn't have much relevance to my own life. I read a poem once in a while, people say. So I think in 50 years, I can say, you know, I think I'm going to read another novel this year. It'll be a most special and peculiar activity almost, because I think television is driving everything else out.
But how do you size yourself up now when you compare yourself to the other major writers of your generation?
Oh, I think, I'm not going to name them. I think about three or four of us who may last, and I would say I'm one of them.
Your image has always been of the two-fisted intellectual, and you've said that you were a physical coward as a child. When did being manly and being able to fight become important to you?
In my second marriage, my then-wife's father had been a professional fighter, and whenever he came over to visit us, he used to say, come on, let's put on the gloves. He was about 20 years older than me, but of course he knew more about boxing than I did. So I learned quickly and the hard way. And then after that, I got interested in it and did more and more boxing. And then I became friends with a couple of professional fighters. And finally, I've had a great friendship with Jose Torres over the years. And I've boxed with him a great deal. At one time, he was the light heavyweight champion of the world. Now, of course, boxing with someone who's as good as that is relatively safe because, he can handle you with no pain, and therefore he has no particular interest in hurting you. But I did learn an awful lot about defense while boxing with him, because if he tapped me once, and then if I didn't make the proper move the next time, he tapped me a little harder. So after a while, he put a great many instinctive defensive moves into me.
But getting back to that image of the two-fisted intellectual, why was that important to you, to not just be a bookish intellectual?
Well, I can answer you by saying, why not? What's so wonderful about being a bookish intellectual? If you're just bookish, there's a tendency to get terribly bitter about people who are physical. And my feeling always from the beginning was, if I want to be a novelist, I've got to be a novelist who can encompass all kinds of experience. My ambition was always, don't ever narrow down the horizons of what you want to write about. Try for as much as you possibly can try for. Learn more all the time. It's stultifying to be a novelist unless you keep opening up working with larger and larger, not necessarily larger and larger canvases, but either larger canvases or more powerful themes.
Norman Mailer speaking with Terry Gross. Today is Mailer's 80th birthday. We'll hear more of their 1991 conversation after the break. This is Fresh Air. We return now to Terry Gross's 1991 interview with Norman Mailer. He has a new book, The Spooky Art, Thoughts on Writing.
You went from Harvard into the Army. I think you fought in the Philippines during World War II.
Yes.
Was that the first time that physical strength counted more than intellectual ability in your life?
I would say so, yes. In fact, I went through... I grew up in Brooklyn, and, we didn't ignore strength in Brooklyn, but it wasn't... I grew up in a reasonable neighborhood, reasonable middle-class neighborhood. But I do think that what counted for more than strength or the lack of it was the fact that I went from Brooklyn to Harvard to the Army. So I went through two major transitions in 5 years. And the shock of that. And then a few years later, The Naked and the Dead was written and came out. So in a space of about 8 years, I went through three major transitions. The third being that I went from being an unknown young man who just recently gotten out of the Army to being a young celebrity, and that was the largest transition of them all. It was extraordinary.
How did who you saw yourself as being compare when you were in Harvard and when you were in the Army?
Well, I just had a totally different view of myself. Young people at Harvard. Harvard was a wonderful place in those days, and you were coddled a bit. We were treated as gentlemen. We were treated as young people who are going to be. Without ever saying it, the assumption was that we were going to play a reasonably interesting role in life, and everybody cultivated everyone else's opinion. I remember it as an incredibly polite place and very nice. And even if you were discriminated against, you never knew it. It was all done so subtly. Whereas the Army, of course, was rough as a corn cob. And so that was a huge transition. And then I wasn't very good in the Army. I wasn't a good soldier. And I'd gone from having a rather elevated opinion of myself to a poor opinion of myself. So my ego was on the elevator in those days.
In what way weren't you a good soldier?
Oh, I mean, I just resented close-order drill completely. I don't think I ever learned to march properly or present arms or any of that stuff. And I don't know. I just wasn't a particularly good soldier. If you had 12 soldiers in a platoon, I'd be the third or the fourth from the bottom.
Was it important to you as a writer to be in the Army and meet men who weren't like you, who weren't from the same background or the same region?
Oh, I think it turned me into an altogether different kind of writer. If I'd never gone to the Army, I believe I would have written novels that probably would have been a little bit like the works of Iris Murdoch. Maybe not as good, but I would have had intricate philosophical novels with characters who, to say the least, would be somewhat extreme and distorted and intense. And going to the Army, talking in quick terms, maybe much more of a naturalist.
Was your ego intact after the military when you started to write?
No, I went through the, my ego was battered. And I went through the war very much with the attitude of, when I get out, I'm going to write a book about it, expose this damn Army. Now, everybody I knew in the Army was saying the same thing. But I used to think, yeah, they're saying it, but I'm going to do it. And I hated the Army. Now, looking back on it, I'd say that the Army was the 2 years that I spent in the Army were the worst experience of my life and the most valuable.
You know, you said your ego was on the elevator, you know, between Harvard and the Army. It really started to be on the elevator when you started to write. You know, The Naked and the Dead, as you say, made you into celebrity, but your next two books weren't reviewed as favorably, didn't sell as well. What kind of mood swings did that create in you?
Well, huge mood swings, but the happy end to the story is that by now I have an ego that I'm afraid is like a battleship. Just try and sink it.
Is it good or bad for a writer to have a big ego?
It has its advantages. Obviously, you can go through a mess of bad reviews. And, you know, most of my books over the years have had more bad reviews than good reviews. I'm the only major writer in America who has had more bad reviews than good reviews in the course of his writing life. So that gives me a certain a pride in it. You know, they keep taking their shot, their best shot, and they can't do a goddamn thing. They're not going to stop me. And, you know, and you can get a little vain about it that way. But the bad part about having a tough ego is you become less percipient. Ego is a shell, essentially. And so you start to close off experience from yourself. The ideal would be to have a light, flexible ego that's there, that can concentrate in a given place to protect you when the going gets tough, but that it doesn't cut off too much. At my worst, I often feel like a turtle. I just pull my head in and let it rattle off the shell.
Right.
But, of course, I'm not seeing a damn thing except my own darkness at that point.
The writer Blanche McCreary Boyd had an appreciation of your work recently in The Village Voice. She wrote, Mailer's work has demonstrated an aggressive sexism, and he has, as a consequence, become a cultural icon of offensiveness about women. Do you think you deserve to be a cultural icon of offensiveness about women?
Well, why don't you read the rest of her?
Oh, she loved your work. I just thought this was one way of getting to this issue. I should say here, she really loves your work and the new novel as well, just to put this into context.
Well, I just shrug when we get into that because she started with that to show the distance that the book took her.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, as she read the book, as I understood her review, she was saying, in effect, I'm beginning to forgive him more and more because this book is so good. And finally, at the end, she was saying, it hardly matters what I think his ideas and his attitudes are toward women. I just... I love this book because it just keeps me reading and so forth and so forth. Whatever, it's hard for me to talk about a good review. After all, a man my age who's preening is kind of silly. But as far as being an icon of the awful to a lot of women's liberationists, yes, it's absolutely true. But I also think it's silly. I don't think they read me. I think they proceed on a notion of me that's very little to do with what I really write about all the time. I think if they were to read what I write, they'd be startled. On the other hand, I think the worst of the women's liberationists are incapable of reading. They're interested only in political correctness. So how the hell can they read?
I want to read something that you wrote in the 1950s in advertisements for myself. You wrote, "Fitzgerald was an indifferent caretaker of his talent, and I have been a cheap gambler with mine. As I add up the accounts, I cannot like myself too much, for I was cowardly when I should have been good and too brave on many a bad chance. And I spent my first 30 years abusing my body, and the last 6 in forced marches on my brain. And so I am more stupid today than I ought to be. My memory is half gone, and my mind is slow. From fear and vanity, I paid out too much for what I managed to learn. I may have wasted too much of myself, and if I have, what a loss." Can you update that for us? Do you ever feel like, Do you ever feel those kinds of emotions that you expressed when you were 36 in that passage?
No. In the act of writing that, I was able to move away from that. You know, much of writing is I wouldn't call it exorcism, but it is transformation. Very occasionally, it's transcendence. If you can absolutely capture a state of mind at a given moment, then you very often are freed of that state of mind. That was written out of the deep fear. In those years, it was written out of the deep fear that I had ruined myself.
From
these abuses, you know, pot, booze, all of that. But I think in the course of writing it, some little part of me said, well, stop complaining so much, because actually this is rather a well-written passage.
At the age of 68, which you are now, do you feel that you have no time for certain shenanigans that you participated in when you were younger?
Oh, time is obsessive now. Not obsessive, that's too strong a word, but it's present in almost every thought I have, put it that way. You know, I don't know how much longer I have, 10 years, 15 years at most, and there's so many things I want to get done yet. So, no, I have no time for shenanigans. I've got to get the work out.
Has your approach to writing and rewriting changed at all over the years?
Talking about the process.
Yeah.
Well, I now look upon myself as having somewhat less talent than I had in the middle years, but I have much more skill and savvy, and I'm a much better editor of my own work. I'm sure there are any number of reviewers who would disagree, but in any event, that's the way I feel. And so I feel if I can get something written that's halfway decent, by the time I get done editing it, it'll be pretty good. Whereas in the old days, I used to write with more smoke and less savvy.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Well, thank you. It went very quickly.
Norman Mailer, speaking with Terry Gross in 1991. Today, he turns 80. Mailer has a new book, The Spooky Art, Thoughts on Writing. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com, from the National Endowment for the Arts, and by Anchor Books, publishers of the paperback novel Balzac and the Little Chinese Seamstress by Dai Siji. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The Library of Congress has just made this year's selections for its National Registry. Included are Tito Puente's Tanzmania and The Message by Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five. Coming up, we'll speak with Grandmaster rapper Melly Mel. And TV critic David Bianculli previews Kingpin and Dragnet, both premiering this Sunday.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. That's Béla Bartók's 1940 Rhapsody No. 1 with Joseph Sigeti, violin. One of the 50 recordings selected last week by the Library of Congress for the new National Registry of Sound Recordings. Charlie Parker also made the list. That's Charlie Parker's 1945 recording of Coco. Other selections for the registry include turn-of-the-century cylinder recordings of the Metropolitan Opera, the live radio broadcast describing the crash of the Hindenburg, and Kate Smith singing God Bless America. The most recently produced recording is from 1982. Many people consider The Message among the best rap records ever made, and it's probably the first rap record that offered social commentary. It was recorded by Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five. Melly Mel did the rap.
It's like a jungle sometimes. It makes me wonder how I keep from going under. It's like a jungle sometimes. It makes me wonder how I keep from going under. Broken glass everywhere, people pissing on the stairs, you know they just don't care. I can't take the smell, can't take the noise, got no money to move out, I guess I got no choice. Rats in the front room, roaches in the back, junkies in the alley with the baseball bat. I tried to get away, but I couldn't get far, cause a man with a tow truck repossessed my car. Don't push me, cause I'm close to the edge. I'm trying not to lose my head. It's like a jungle sometimes. It makes me wonder how I keep from going under. Standing on the front stoop, hanging out the window, watching all the cars go by, roaring as the breezes blow. A crazy lady living in.
When Melly Mel recorded The Message, most rap records were party boasts. The Message was a departure from Melly Mel. It was actually his record company that brought him the original lyric of the rap, which was written by Duke Booty. Terry Gross spoke with Melly Mel in 1992.
Our group, like Flash and the Furious Five, we didn't actually want to do The Message because we was used to doing party raps, you know, and like boasting about how good we are and all that. And when the record company brought the record to us to do, we didn't actually want to do it. And I was the only one that, like, I just caved in. I said, listen, if this is the record we're going to do, then I'll just do it, and it's no big thing. But I didn't think that it would be pivotal either way, you know, like on a good or bad end. I just thought it was going to be just another record that we had did.
So did you ever try The Message at parties before you went into the recording studio, or would that have been all wrong?
No, we never tried it. And as a matter of fact, I was shocked because we used to hang out in a club called Disco Fever up in the Bronx, right? And then they took the record, you know, they was testing it, like they tested it down on a record shop on 125th Street, you know, just putting it, you know, just letting it play and people outside, you know, listening to it. And then they tested it in the club where we hung out at, and the people really liked it. And that was coming right behind Planet Rock, which was a big, big record back then. And when they played The Message in the club and the people liked it, I was kind of shocked because I didn't think that, you know, coming from Planet Rock to, you know, a serious record like The Message, I didn't think that, I thought it would be like a lapse in you know, the level of the crowd, the intensity of the crowd. But it wasn't. So, yeah, right then I knew that the record was going to be more than what I thought it was going to be.
Can I ask you how you started rapping?
when we started going to parties, they used to be like little, like maybe $1 parties, $2 parties, and they had a DJ called Kool Herc. Yeah, well, it was all DJs, but they rapped. They didn't actually rap in rhythm, but they used to say little phrases, you know, Coke, LaRock, Timmy Tim, and Clark Kent. That was the guys' names. And they was the big DJs. They was like the big DJs back then. And we used to go to their parties, and I just started rapping, just trying to emulate them, you know, to be like them, because they was like more or less our heroes back then.
What were some of the kinds of rhymes they were using?
They wouldn't use rhymes. It's like if you could imagine, it would be like a dark room or a gym, and it's like smoky because everybody was smoking everything from cigarettes to whatever, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd be playing the music, and then it'd all be echo chamber. So they'd be like, rock, 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 free, free, free. You know,
right.
It was like more or less like kind of a psychedelic kind of thing, because everything they said, it was echoes, you know. And this is why they call me the Shoe Machine Shock, y'all. You know, it was like all this echoing. And you walk in there, you'd be like dumbfounded, because it's like you just stepped into another world, you know what I mean? And there's all these dark figures around and smoke, and, you know, it was like awesome. You know, for us, it was like a rush, you know, just stepping into these parties.
So what were the early rhymes you were doing?
We was doing like, you know, I'm Melly Mel and I rock so well from the top of the world to the depths of hell. This is my first rhyme. I rock with the best, with the most finesse. I'm taking the top and leaving what's left. Like real simple stuff, you know, just boasting rhymes, you know, nothing real heavy or nothing like that, or nothing real technical, because there was no technique. We was just going by our own thing.
How did you come up with your name, Melly Mel?
Flash gave me that name. Because that was my name was just Melvin, so I don't think that would be like a cool name, like, right. You know, MC Melvin. So Flash, you know, he started calling me Melly Mel, and it stuck.
Where were the parties held?
In gyms, in not too many halls. We did basically the first halls, but it was like in gyms and like little social club type things. Herc the Hevelo. That was, I guess, was a club. I never was there, but he used to play in the PAL, and that was like a gym. You know, little halls, you know, nothing big or extravagant. But it was like, you know, nice little small dark joints, you know, real comfortable, sweaty, you know.
Was there often trouble at the parties?
Yeah, but like the trouble at the parties was like it was set up like, it was nothing going on in the party itself, right? But all the guys that, like, did stick-ups and stuff like that, they'd be in the bathroom. So when you went to the bathroom, if you didn't know these guys, then they'd rob you. So that it wasn't like how it is now. Like, guys would actually be in the party itself and shoot up the party, or maybe they'd come outside and shoot up the party. If you got shot, you might get shot in the bathroom. You know, that was, like, the only spot that you'd have to be wary of, basically. And then you did have your isolated instances, you know, something happening outside, but it would never happen in the party, so to speak. It'd always be like away from the party.
So would you go to the bathroom? Did you know enough people that
it was
safe for you to go?
I knew everybody, so it was definitely safe. I knew, you know, from, because before I was rapping, I used to be a dancer, so, you know, I just met like all of the stick up guys, all the dope dealing guys. I knew them all. Or if I didn't know them, I was familiar with them. So, you know, if it's a familiar face, they might let you come and go, you know. And I wasn't no sharp dress. I didn't have no jewelry or nothing like that, or no clean sneakers or, you know, something that, you know, they would want to take. So, you know, I was always safe.
What was the transition like for you from parties to recording studios and concert dates, theaters?
Well, it definitely wasn't hard to do, because even when we was doing like the parties, we seen ourselves like we put ourselves on an entertainment's level, or entertainer's level. It's like we used to set up, you know, tables and build our own little stage and do our little dance routines. So it wasn't nothing for us to go from, you know, point A to point. As far as rappers go, it's like when Rappers Delight, when Sugar Hill Gang made Rappers Delight, and when we did our first show with them, we blew them out.
What was it like when you started making more money and getting really well known? How did you handle that? I think that's difficult for a lot of people to handle.
Yeah, and I guess it was especially difficult for us back then, because, you know, we started, you know, abusing a lot of things, you know, abusing the money, you know, and messing with drugs and stuff like that, you know, hanging out. You know, we got into that kind of thing. So I guess, And we didn't really have no good management or somebody that we looked up to tell us what to do and what not to do in moderation, or what was cool or what was going to be what was going to add to our longevity, because, you know, we was just out there and we was on top, and we just thought that, you know, things was never going to run out. And, you know, eventually they did, because we was very abusive about our career.
So what happened when things ran out?
Well, everybody just, you know, went their own direction, you know. It's like at one point Flash and them had took up a lawsuit against the record company, and, you know, some of the brothers was using drugs. I started using drugs. You know, everything just got real herky-jerky.
Rapper Melly Mel speaking with Terry Gross. He was the vocalist on the 1982 recording of The Message with Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five. The Message is one of the 50 recordings selected by the Library of Congress for its new National Registry. We'll continue Terry's interview with Melly Mel after the break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back now to Terry's interview with rapper Melly Mel. He's the vocalist of the 1982 rap The Message, one of the recordings chosen for the new National Registry of Sound Recordings by the Library of Congress.
Another great record that you made was White Lines, which is a kind of anti-cocaine record. You know,
right.
It's White Lines, don't do it.
Right.
So here you were actually doing drugs while you were making the rap.
Right. But, you know, see, the whole thing with White Lines is I didn't want to try to make an anti-cocaine song or a song that glorified cocaine. I just wanted to make a song about cocaine, and that was a hit song. Because the music that we used, it wasn't original music. We used it, you know, it was like a club song, Liquid Liquid. That was the name of the song. And, you know, I used to be in the club, and it's like if you ever hear a song and sing your own words to it, in other words. And they were saying something in their record, and every time I would hear it, I would just say, White Lines, you know. And I was like, you know, it could be a good idea to make a song. And that was all a part of the scene anyway, you know, the club scene back then. It was like cocaine then. It wasn't like how it is now. It was more fashionable, you know what I mean? It was fashionable to have it. And I started out not even, you know, I didn't use cocaine. I should just have it because it was fashionable just to have it. You come in the club, you know, everybody know you got blow. Girls know you got coke. And, you know, it was in the euphoria of that, just having it, and people that know you have it, and they treat you better. And all that accumulated to me writing that song, you know, because that's the lifestyle that I was in. I wasn't around nobody that didn't use drugs.
Bass. Vision, dreams of passion. And all the while I think of you. A very strange reaction. The more I see, the more I do. Baby. Ride, White Line Highway, tell all your friends they can go my way, pay your toll, sell your soul, pound for pound, cost more than gold. The longer you stay, the more you pay. My white lines go a long way, either up your nose or through your vein, with nothing to gain except killing your brain.
How did you come up with the idea of using the higher?
That was just something that came naturally with the song, with the twist and shout thing.
Mm-hmm.
It just came naturally. That was like, me piecing it together in my mind after the verse. And it's, higher, baby, higher, you know, and it all fell together. It was something real natural. As a matter of fact, before I even did the song, I even had a dream that went after that I did the song and I heard it and I was in the club and the song was playing. So it's like I heard the song in my head even before we even did the record. So I knew exactly how I wanted the record to sound, so to speak.
If you're just joining us, my guest is rapper Melly Mel. Can I ask you about your family when you were growing up?
Well, our family was more or less, say, not really a dysfunctional family, but it was, you know, it was like my pops drank, and, you know, him and my mother, they couldn't read, so they, you know, used to make us go to school. You know, the important thing was learning how to read. And, you know, it was like that. He drank, and he was abusive. So it's like not the average ghetto family, but, you know, that's nothing new as far as, you know, ghettos go.
So was reading important to you? Did you like to read?
Well, I didn't like to read, but I knew if I did read or if I could learn how to read, you know, things would be easier, you know.
So when did like words start really meaning something to you?
When I started rapping, because that's when I understood, you know, how you could put the right words together and make, it's almost like making magic, especially when you rhyme. It's like I used to always think back to, you see a witch in front of a cauldron and she's stirring up and she's saying like a rhyme, you know, it always would be a rhyme of all things. And it's like, and to me, my rhymes is like magic, you know. You could make your own magic, especially if you believe, if you're saying something and you believe in what it is that you're saying, is like magic once you put the right words together.
Did you ever go through a period in your life when things were hard, when you were busted for anything and ended up having to do time?
Oh yeah, when I was very young, though. That was all before I started rapping. Like, you know, just being out in the streets, you know, and running around, you know, robbing people, you know, doing stuff like that, like stupid stuff.
Now, how much time did you spend in prison?
I didn't spend no real time. I spent, like, say, 11 days in juvenile prison, and I spent 5 days in Rikers Island. Because I lied, right? And I told the cops that I was overage because I didn't want my family. It's like when you get busted at a young age and it's late, right? They'll call your house or they'll send the cops to your house and your mother would have to come pick you up. But I didn't want to have to go through that because I knew I'd get a whooping or whatever, right? And I told the cops that I was older and then they sent me to Rikers Island for 5 days.
Was that a terrifying experience?
Not really. You know, thinking back on it, I guess I was scared then, but, you know, I think I was more scared of getting a whooping if my moms and pops would have came to get me. So
that's kind of amazing. You'd be more afraid of what your parents were going to do than spending a few days in Rikers Island, which is really one of the worst prisons.
Well, that's what happens when you have a father, you see, because you got to be afraid of your father. And that's how you get respect for law, you know, because somebody's got to be the head. So you definitely was afraid, you know, of what your father would do. That's like the biggest, you know, that's your biggest fear.
So after a few days in prison, did that scare you away from doing anything that would land you back in prison, or did you feel, well, I can take this, I can manage this?
No, what it was like being in prison and seeing what prison life is so pathetic. It was so pathetic to me that the only time that if I wanted to do a crime, it would have to be like for hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars. Because, I mean, when you see guys in prison. And I've got, like, not really went to prison, but, like, being arrested and being, like, in the bullpen area, like, or central booking or whatever. And the stuff that guys get busted for that are in prison is, like, you'll never see, like, a John Gotti or, you know, you see, like, a guy, you know, he smacked his wife on the leg or, you know, somebody that robbed a little corner store. Those are the guys that are in prison. And then they all think they know so much about the law and, you know, they're taking each other's sneakers. It's so pathetic. It's so pathetic that anybody with a right mind wouldn't even want to be in jail for, you know, no longer than they would have to stay there. Like that two-time loser or the three-time loser, he's a fool because he is nothing in jail except for a bunch of guys that don't even know why they in jail. They too stupid to know that they in jail because they were stupid enough to do something and get caught. And that's all the guys that's in jail. And I didn't think that. I knew that I was too smart to be that stupid, you know, just to do something. And then, you know, oh, man, the policeman or the white man, you know, you did something stupid and you got caught. You were stupid enough to get caught.
I got one last question for you. On your, like, official documents, credit cards, if you have them, or driver's license, do you use the name Melly Mel or do you use your birth name?
No, my birth name, Melvin Glover. That's my name.
So how do you feel about that name now?
It's a nice name. You know, I don't really think here nor there about it. You know, some people hear the name Glover, they say, are you related to Danny Glover? I'd be like, my pops was named Danny Glover.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
All right. Well, listen, thanks so much for talking with us.
Anytime.
Melly Mel spoke with Terry Gross in 1992. The rap The Message has just been picked as one of the 50 sound recordings worthy of preservation by the Library of Congress.
So don't push me, 'cause I'm close to the edge. I'm trying not to lose my head. It's like a jungle sometimes, it makes me wonder how I keep from going under. It's like a jungle sometimes, it makes me wonder how I keep from going under.
Yo, Mel, you see that girl, man?
Yeah, man.
Yo, that sound like Cowboy, man.
What's up, cool?
Yo, what's up, money?
Yo.
Hey, where's Creole and Raheem, man?
Hey, upstairs, cooling out.
So what's up for the night, y'all?
Yo, we can go down to Fever, man.
Go check out Junebug, man.
Hey, yo, you know that girl, Betty?
Yeah, man.
My mom's got robbed, man.
Not
what?
Again,
she got hurt.
What did this happen? What did this happen?
What's going on? Freeze, don't nobody move nothing. Y'all know what this is. Get him up.
What?
Get him up.
Yo, man, we down with
right
Grandmaster the Flash and the Fury.
Coming up, Dragnet and Kingpin. This is Fresh Air. Sunday night, two networks are slugging it out by launching gritty new crime dramas at the same time. NBC has a new crime series called Kingpin about a Mexican drug cartel, and ABC has a remake of Dragnet starring Ed O'Neill from Married with Children. Fresh Air TV critic David Bianculli has seen them both.
Though their creators might argue about this, both of these new series are pretty blatant copies. ABC's new Dragnet by Law & Order creator Dick Wolf is upfront about it. More than Wolf has ever been before. After all, his Law and Order shows, at least in the police procedural parts, are doing the same just-the-facts, ma'am stuff that Jack Webb pioneered on Dragnet more than 50 years ago. But NBC's Kingpin, in essence, is a copy too, but not from one source, and not as good. It takes a little from the movie Traffic, a lot from the movie The Godfather, and a whole lot from HBO's The Sopranos. What it comes up with is a Mexican Michael Corleone, a refined but ambitious young man who rises through the ranks of the illegal family business. NBC, which has Dick Wolf's Law & Order franchises sewn up, wants Kingpin to be its Sopranos, the kind of show that will get a lot of attention and viewers by being bold and violent and outrageous and morally ambiguous. ABC, with Dragnet, wants to cash in on the familiar pre-sold name of that original series, and also covets Dick Wolf's Law & Order franchise. By wooing Wolf from NBC to make a new Dragnet, ABC essentially is getting two franchises in one. But if either Kingpin or Dragnet doesn't attract a lot of viewers right out of the box, don't expect them to return in the fall. In this battle of hero versus villain, the sergeant of Dragnet and the drug lord of Kingpin, there's likely to be only one winner. I'm guessing that Dragnet has the edge here, because people will be curious to see if Ed O'Neill, who played the buffoonish father on Married with Children, can pull off Jack Webb's Joe Friday role. O'Neill played it straight recently in another TV cop show, Big Apple, but almost no one cared or watched. This time, though, he's playing an icon. Literally from the very beginning, this new Dragnet is faithful to the original. By the time O'Neill shows up on camera, investigating a crime scene with young partner Frank Smith, played by Ethan Embry, O'Neill already has introduced his character and the tone of the show with his trademark narration.
The story you are about to see was inspired by actual events. The names have been changed to protect the innocent.
It was Monday. It was overcast in Los Angeles. My partner and I were working the day shift out of robbery-homicide. The captain was Ruth Hagerman. Parks and Recreation received an AM complaint about excessive noise. Coyotes. Kinda odd. There had to be some reason for them to be out in broad daylight. We smelled the reason before we could see it. A white Jane Doe decomposing. Cause of death unknown. My name's Friday. I'm a cop. Start canvassing
the homes around the original series, 50 years ago, labeled its stories as true. In the 21st century, they're merely inspired by actual events. But more so than most remakes of classic TV series, Dragnet cares about being true to the spirit of the original, and it works. It's not that different, really, from another Law & Order or from a CSI. But the point is, Dragnet got there first, long, long before any of those shows existed. Why not reclaim the original territory? Kingpin, I'm a little less enthusiastic about. I wanted to like this series, but after previewing two episodes, I find it very difficult to care. Cheryl Lee, as the wife of the central character, gives the best performance in the series and is by far the most interesting element of the show. But she's not supposed to be. And though Yancey Arias as Miguel is a good actor, most of the characters around him are too unbelievable or over the top to be accepted as anything but stereotypes or cartoons. If I had to choose, and I do, I'm going with Dragnet.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of Unhinged, A Home Repair is Homicide Mystery by Sarah Graves, author of Wreck the Halls. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, back from Baghdad, we'll talk with Boston Globe reporter Elizabeth Newfer, who's just returned from Iraq. Join us for the next Fresh Air.